I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with the English tenor and writer Ian Bostridge. Ian Bostridge is happily and articulately fixed on a musical mountaintop. It's Franz Schubert's deathbed song cycle, Winterreise, the winter journey of a desperate traveler toward madness and death. Think of these 24 songs as the first and all-time concept album, written in 1827 by another one of those Viennese geniuses in the footprints of Mozart and Beethoven. When Ian Bostridge sings and records these Schubert songs, he's revealing a path that many moderns still find themselves on. And his book on the songs chases down some of the implications along the way. Ian Bostridge, I am envious and maybe a little obsessed right now with your obsession with Franz Schubert and his cycle of songs, The Winter Journey, Winterreise, auf Deutsch. But first, my short form of what I know about Schubert. He was a demigod, obviously, of musical Vienna in Beethoven time, popular and prolific, hundreds of songs and chamber pieces, 7 finished symphonies and 1 famously unfinished one. But it's this set of 24 songs, The Winter Journey, finished on his deathbed, age 31, that sort of seals his genius. I can't not be reminded of Charlie Parker, who remade jazz in the 1940s, then died a heroin addict at 34. Schubert died apparently of syphilis. His Winter Journey, in any event, makes almost any short list of the faultless master creations in any category of art, up there with Don Quixote and the Taj Mahal, or Moby Dick, or My Fair Lady. And you get to live inside those songs on stage year after year, and now inside this omnidirectional book on the anatomy of an obsession. Your book sets a sort of example in nonstop digression, so let's just take a handful of these songs and play the game. Mm-hmm. Starting with Good Night at the beginning, Gute Nacht, which propels the whole story. He's leaving his sweetheart's house. Her mother may have wanted him to marry her. The father may have said, get out of here. But there he is, out on the road.
Yeah, I think it's purposefully unclear what's gone on. It's very bare, and the narrative is sort of concealed, I suppose. But on the one hand, I think that's a great thing in a work of art, because I think certainly all fiction, and this is a fiction, works on the basis of drawing the reader in by the reader being able to project his or her own experiences onto the work of art. So for there to be lacunae and absences is very helpful, and it's a typical technique, for example, in Byron, that he leaves something out so you can imagine that you're him.
Maybe the poor devil has syphilis.
That's why he's leaving. Well, that's possible. I suppose he may have been thinking that. I mean, I think it's good to connect it to what Schubert was thinking about at the time, because it's good to think, why was Schubert particularly drawn to these poems? Because he discovered the first 12 in a magazine, an almanac called Urania, and he sat down and composed them straight through pretty quickly. And then when he discovered another load of poems, which were subsumed into a larger Winterreise of the poet Wilhelm Müller, he just sat down and wrote all those out too. So they had a particular appeal for him. And I think there are all sorts of things in the cycle that have an appeal for him. In the first song, I think particularly, and here I'm going against what I said, because I've said it's nice that it's open-ended, but I think we ask, why was this guy in this house? This is sometime in the 1820s. He says, I'm leaving this house. The girl spoke of love. The mother spoke of marriage, and now I'm going out wandering. And you think, well, why was this young man living in this house? Who is he? What's he doing there? It seems rather peculiar. I've never really thought about this clearly. And it suddenly occurred to me that he's probably a private tutor in the house, which is something that so many of the people of this period, of the great thinkers of this period, did. Hölderlin, Schubert himself, actually, taught in a private household and fell in love with a girl. And it's an inappropriate thing, and it often leads to problems. And it's something Rousseau wrote about really famously in probably the most famous novel of the late 18th century, which was still current in the 1820s, which is called The Nouvelle Héloïse.
So how do you keep track of the moods, even in this song? I mean, but certainly in the set, they go from deeply depressive to ecstatic to loving to
I think the first song is a sort of study in how to do it. When I first performed the cycle, which was when I was about 19 or 20, I found this one really intimidating because it's essentially strophic, which means it's the roughly speaking the same tune with different verses. There are minor changes, and then there's a magical shift from the minor key into the major key in the last verse. But it's long, it's longer than probably than almost all of the other songs. It's quite moderate in pace, so it's a lot of music. It's quite repetitive. And one of the ways of dealing with that is to think, well, I better change it. So when I get to to verse three and it talks about dogs barking and I'm being thrown out, you could get louder. But actually, as I've thought about the cycle more, I think what you need to have in this song, Good Night, he's saying good night, is this sense that he's creeping away and he's being quite quiet because he doesn't want to wake anybody up. And you need to have this sense that even when the emotion is surging underneath, everything is being kept under wraps.
Off it goes.
Mm-hmm.
In what state between ecstasy and melancholy?
I think he's numb at the beginning, and then the last thing he says is, "I'm going to write on the door as I go, good night, to show you that I thought about you." And that's the music slows down slightly, and he says, "To show you that I thought about you." And then we trudge on, and there's a sense of in the music almost of I hear the scrunch, the squeak of the snow in the music almost. And I think, yeah, it's a numbness to begin with. But what we get in the cycle as a whole is a huge range of emotions. I mean, people often think of Winterizer as being a gloomy cycle. And it's a dark cycle. It's not a jolly cycle. It's not a sort of laugh a minute, but it has a lot of different moods in it. As you say, ecstasy, anger, a sort of sublimity, and it's overall, I think it's incredibly varied. And that's one of the reasons I called the book Anatomy of an Obsession. I am obsessed with the piece and that I've been performing it over and over again, but I think I was also in the back of my mind referring back to that great work of the 17th century, Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy. And in a way, this is a sort of anatomy of various forms of emotion, including melancholy, and maybe many, many different forms of melancholy, yeah.
What's the difference between being obsessed with a piece and just performing it many, many times, as a lot of actors and singers do?
I suppose not being able to quite to get to the bottom of it. You can't, which means you keep going back to it and worrying at it and trying to do it better. There are some works where I suppose you pin it down quite early on, and maybe they're not such great works, I don't know. And then you pin them down, then you leave them for a bit and go back to them. Whereas Winterizer is a piece I go back to again and again and again. I've never really had a gap with it, and it's never got boring. So that's part of the nature of the obsession.
Skip three or four songs to the Lindenbaum, the linden tree. It always sounds to me now like a global folk song. I think every 7 billion people know this melody, but it has a particular symbolic meaning, the linden tree, and a very specific plot sense. He can't get the rustling of these branches out of his head. What's that all about?
It's about memory. It's about what T.S. Eliot calls a sort of mixing memory and desire. And what he's saying in the song really is that he's tempted to go back. He's tempted to think about the past, but he shouldn't do that. He should move forward. Of course, he does still, in subsequent songs, pick at the wound and go back to the past, but I think he's expressing the pointlessness of it. The other thing that the song is about, and I think this is something that's maybe taken over too much because of the influence of Thomas Mann, who uses a song to such effect in his great novel, The Magic Mountain, where at the end his hero, Hans Castorp, sort of goes off into a muddy First World War landscape singing this song under his breath. And Mann saw and used the idea of the song Lindenbaum as a sort of example of German obsession with death. He thought that what the tree is actually saying is come back and lie down underneath me in the snow and die. And there's an element of that, I'm sure, but I don't think it's the whole of what the song's about.
Where did Schubert find that melody in his head?
It's a very simple melody. It's very restricted in range. The intervals are quite simple intervals, which is what I think is why it became a folk song. I mean, it became a folk song even more simplified, and taking away all the complexities that are introduced to the song in the middle section, where there's a little bit of a storm going on. But that's what you often find with Schubert, is that melodies are such a mysterious business. I mean, people make such a big thing about people being great melodists. But very often it's the harmony that gives the melody its real character, I find.
We come to the flood, the water flood, and again, one of these extreme temperature things. He talks about glowing hot tears falling into cold snow, down to the ground. What's this flood about?
Ah, gosh. It's about question. It's about partly about a questioning of authenticity when he talks about his tears. I mean, tears were had been a very almost political matter, because at the end of the 18th century there was this growth of a movement called sensibility, and it fed into the French Revolution, and crying was seen in a way as an index of authenticity, an authentic feeling. And by the time we're getting into the 1820s and 1830s, the reaction against that period, you start to get the feeling that actually tears are rather embarrassing, and if you cry, you question why you're crying, and actually if you're a man, you hold back on tears. You don't do the thing that Goethe's Werther does in that great novel, The Sorrows of Young Werther, which I think it was Roland Barthes said that crying stands in for a carnal exchange of fluids. So that goes out of fashion. But here we're seeing it questioned, I think, and ironized.
Then comes the post, which conjures to me a picture of a sort of a mail coach passing this guy, but he catches sight of a return address from the town of his sweetheart. And it drives him nuts, and these incredibly beautiful cries of my heart, which you sing beautifully. Do I have the picture right?
Yeah, what really struck me looking into this song was we tend to think from a 21st century perspective of the mail coach as being something archaic. We think of, you know, Mr. Pickwick and the whole Dickensian thing. Whereas actually, from the perspective of the 1820s, and even from the perspective of the English writer Thomas de Quincey, who wrote about it a little bit later, the mail coach in the 1820s was incredibly exciting. It was very, very fast.
It was a huge advance.
Yeah, huge advance. I mean, one historian says rather, I think rather controversially, but he's obviously thought about it, but a German historian called Wolfgang Beringer thinks that actually the shift from the speeds of the 16th century to those of the early 19th century is much bigger than the shifts from the 19th century through to the modern day.
To space travel, yeah.
I mean, I think it's to do with not only the actual literal speed of the mail coach, which was fast, but the introduction of relentless systematization. So you've got, you know, clocks, timetables, better suspension, roads. Suddenly everything seemed a bit relentless, and there was no, people couldn't shilly-shally and dilly-dally anymore. And some people found that very threatening. And that's what we get, I think, as a contrast in... it's a contrast we need to remember in Depos. It's a contrast between this wanderer who's sort of seems to be aimlessly wandering around the snowy landscape, and the sort of purposeful modern rush of the stagecoach of the Depos.
And it tortures him, of course, to see that address and think, should I go back? Does she want me back?
It's almost the last time that he really thinks about going back, but it's become almost unquestionable by that stage. I feel that he's not going to go back, and he moves from the end of that song, which it ends in a very sort of pat way. He says, shall I go back? No. And then we move straight into the most metaphysical, sort of extraordinary song of all, really, certainly so far, Der Greise Kopf, where he gets frost on his beard and hair, and he thinks, gosh, I've become an old man. Brilliant. I'm going to die soon and all this will be over. And then it melts and he's disappointed. So we plunge into the deepest thought suddenly from the idea we leave the girl behind and we're getting existential. Der Reif hat einen weißen Schein, mildes Haar gestreut.
Permit me to just remember two television pieces I did, as it happened, with two wood engravers, old men, really accomplished artists. And in the late editing of these pieces, I called each of them. First, Fritz Eichenberg. And I said, Fritz, we never spoke of the music of this piece. What should it be? And he said, well, of course, it should be Die Lagermann from Schubert's, you know, The End of the Winterreise, as if any dummy should know that. And he saw himself as an old organ grinder heading off into death. He was 90 years old, and it always struck me as very expressive. And then maybe 5 years later, we did a piece on another wood engraver, Leonard Baskin. And at the last minute, I called him and said, Leonard, what's the music of this piece? And he said, you idiot, obviously it's Schubert's posthumous piano sonata in B-flat, which has a kind of rumble of death in it, as well as incredibly beautiful, familiar melodies. And I thought, what is it that Schubert grasps about death, about old men, about approaching death, about eternity, about past death, life after death? This is intergalactic music, it strikes me.
Yeah.
This is music of the spheres.
I mean, he's writing with a strong consciousness that he doesn't have long left. I mean, he just before he contracted syphilis, I mean, he probably contracted it in late 1822 and was in hospital in 1823. And a little bit before that, he'd slightly eased up on his extraordinary and ferocious level of productivity. But once he got it, he went on and produced unbelievable quantities of extraordinary music, and particularly the last 18 months, where you've got the quintet, Winterreise, Schwanengesang, the other song. It's two groups of songs by Heine and Rellstab. And as you say, these amazing late piano sonatas. And they're, I suppose, because they're conceived in the presence of death, they have something about, it's very, I mean, one of the things that's so wonderful about music is that you can't put it into words, but because music deals in time, it has a very close connection to our sense of living and dying, I think, and that's what a composer like Schubert or Beethoven in his late quartets and piano sonatas gets to, I think.
Yeah.
And Schubert was definitely he was vying with Beethoven as well. was aware of the presence of Beethoven. How can you go on composing after Beethoven? How can we move on from him? And he's a very different composer from Beethoven, much more discursive, less compressed, and perhaps less analytical, with a very different harmonic language. But I think in this he grapples with those same issues about time and eternity as you know Opus 110 Piano Sonata does.
Such profound connections. I mean, he was younger than Beethoven, lived in Beethoven's world in a certain sense, and died just before him, right?
Died just after him.
Ah, sorry.
Yeah, Schubert lived in the shadow of Beethoven. I mean, he was born in 1797. He was quite a lot younger than Beethoven, but he died only a year after him. He was a pallbearer at his funeral, and a lot of his late works, particularly a symbolic one, is Auf dem Strom, which is all about crossing over a river, and it quotes from the Eroica, and it's a sort of homage to Beethoven, but it has this sense also of death is present because death is crossing a river, you know, Chiron and everything.
Ian Bustridge, speak of the singing effects that you're working on continually here. There's nothing straight or simple, and probably not even stable about the way you present it.
No, one makes vocal discoveries all the time, particularly because it's not an easy cycle in a bel canto way. It's not very obvious who it's written for. I mean, people often think of it as being a baritone cycle, and they think that because of the overwhelming dominance of the recordings and performances of Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, but also because of other German baritones like Hans Hotter and Gerhard Husch and Hermann Prey. But actually, the only voice type that ever sings the cycle in all the original keys is the tenor voice. But it does present problems because there are some growly bits.
Do we suppose Schubert was a tenor?
He was a sort of... He had been a boy soprano. His voice broke. There's a wonderful little note where it says Schubert crowed for the last time on a bit of music in the Vienna choir library where he sang. I think he probably sat at the piano when he first performed the first 12 songs to his friend. He sat at the piano, played, and sort of sang along in a rather a croony way.
Before the end, Ian Bustridge, he sees these three sort of phantom sons, the mock sons, and before it's over, he decides, no, I'd be better off in the dark. Can you explain that?
I suppose he's saying he'd be better off dead, because but he's not allowed to be dead. And what we then get in the last song, one way of interpreting the last song, is what we get is it's sort of eternal recurrence, because we get a song that's incredibly repetitive. So I think there is. I say in Der Lindenbaum, there's not. I want to say that's more about memory than death. But certainly by the end of the cycle, he's saying he wants to lie down in a graveyard, and he says I'd be better off in the dark. So he's longing to be able to give up, but he can't give up. He's got to carry on.
By this point in the program, I mean, we're an hour in when this thing is played straight. Surely we've got a sense of not only a kind of a piercing drama, but of a masterpiece right in front of us. How do we know, and what is it that tells us?
I think the fact that it's incredibly gripping, you hear a certain sort of particular sort of silence, I think, if it's gone well. And each song feeds straight into the next one, and Schubert's incredibly clever in the way that he uses little gestures and little musical shapes to bind all the songs together so that it forms this flow. And I think you just go very, very deep into it. And the feeling at the very end is one of sort of shell shock and amazement, I think. But it's difficult to put your finger on whether it actually means something, but it's quite, in a way, it's questioned everything you could possibly think in the course of it, I think.
And here we are at the very end, the last 24th song, The Hurdy-Gurdy Man, The Leiermann, and something's happened. It's the first one with words in the third person. Mm-hmm. This is not about the man. It's about a man he sees, literally an organ grinder, in effect, barefoot on the ice, swaying back and forth. And he says, "Strange old man, should I go with you?"
Mm-hmm.
To death, obviously, to madness, I think.
Well, or just to be like you. I mean, I think Schubert's great worry, he was the first generation of composer-musicians who lived in the marketplace, didn't have a patron, didn't have a job, neither a sort of ecclesiastical job or a patron and that sort of thing. And I think he saw the fear of becoming an indigent outsider, an old guy stuck outside the village, cold, nobody listening as well, and playing this unbelievably repetitive music, which you could also relate maybe to the symptoms of tertiary syphilis, which he never quite got to. He died probably of something else before he got the mental degeneration that syphilis involves. But it's very easy to see the music of the really weird, bare, repetitive music of Der Leiermann as being syphilitic, I suppose.
There is an anti-romantic sting in that last song. I mean, the sound essentially of a wheel. No sort of climax brought forth for this romantic hero. It ends in a kind of stillness.
Yeah, it ends with a sort of question, well, a question mark or an openness. Shall I go with you? Huh? And then the question isn't answered.
Ian Bostrich's book is Winter Journey, Anatomy of an Obsession. For many more conversations about art, music, ideas, and culture, go to radioopensource.org. And please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. By the way, thanks to all of you who responded to our Kickstarter fundraiser. It was a big success. We raised almost $26,000, well over the goal, to help us expand on the web with new and archival series this spring. Stay tuned. We are propelled by producers Connor Gillies and Max Larkin. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.